Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
So where do Asian noodles fall in your like pantheon of deliciousness?
They're the most important type of carbohydrate to me, if you want to call them that. I have lived for bowls of Asian noodles of all sorts my entire life. I'd rather have any kind of Asian noodles than a loaf of bread or a pastry or even pasta, regular Italian pasta. Forget, I'd give that up in a minute for Asian noodles.
Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and I'm here with food writer and friend of the show, Nancy Leeson. And I feel like we've come to kind of like your mother church in some ways. You want to just explain where we are real quick?
We're at Suchong, the Chinese noodle factory in the Chinatown International District. And I am mortified to say that I've lived here for 30 years. I've eaten at many of the restaurants around here and noodle places elsewhere that serve their noodles. I buy their noodles at Asian supermarkets all over the greater Seattle area, and I have never been to this factory. My heart bleeds for myself and the people who read me or listen to me.
Well, I'm so glad to be on this like religious pilgrimage with you as we visit the heart and soul of the ID's noodle landscape.
Interestingly, people know this place because it's the fortune cookie factory. And frankly, though I can smell that kind of vanilla-y, almond-y flavor just standing outside of this place, I don't care about that at all. I only care about the noodles.
Wow, see, that's where you and I differ. That cookie smell is just like driving me wild right now.
Yeah, and I grew up near a Nabisco factory, and I remember smelling that smell as a child, and I didn't care about it then either. I'd rather go to my local Chinese restaurant and have some noodles.
Man, all right, well, let's go check it out.
Before we head into this palace of starch, a little bit of history. The Suchong Noodle and Fortune Cookie Factory started back in 1917. It's a family business, and inside, we meet its fourth generation owner, Tim Louie. Tim says almost all of the 17 varieties of noodles this place cranks out come from four simple ingredients.
Wheat flour, salt, water, and egg. And from that, we get 17 different noodle products.
That's remarkable. What makes the difference?
The difference is between the different noodle products, you can vary the ratio of the ingredients, like more water, less egg, more water, a wetter mix, drier mix. So that gives you some variety there. When it comes out, we have different cutting dies, cutting heads, if you will. And we have, you know, thick noodles all the way down to skinny noodles. Skinny noodles meaning something equivalent to angel hair. Thick noodles like fettuccine and thicker like the udon style, the real thick round noodle.
So how close could we get to the action here?
Let's go.
All right.
Let's go. If you look way down, there's a platform up there. Two of my workers up there mixing the four ingredients, wheat flour, salt, water, and egg, into pellets or gravel of dough, very similar to like Play-Doh.
Nancy, you look like a kid in a candy shop.
This is my idea of candy. I love this.
I'm excited to see some dough gravel.
Dough gravel?
That's what he was describing. That's how it begins. Oh, wow. And that's gravel.
Like okay, auto cheese or gravel.
So this looks like if you were making pie crust and it was just starting to come together. It's kind of sandy, you know, and then look, watch. So his great-grandfather and his grandfather and the folks that worked here used to do this by hand. Think about that for a minute, right?
Right. Kneading it, rolling it, yeah. Yes. Kneading, rolling, doing all this by hand. No, it's all automatic, done by machine.
Here, feel that, Dave.
Oh, yeah. Yep, it's...
These two look like kids playing with Play-Doh once again.
Kind of smells like Play-Doh.
Yeah. So, again, the four ingredients, they get compacted through compound rollers, and it just fuses all the gravel or pellets of dough into two sheets, and then the two sheets come together and they laminate. Lamination is very important. It gives the noodle the strength and develops the gluten and gives it the stretchiness or the elasticity. Downstream through the many sets of rollers, this sheet of dough gets thinner and thinner and thinner. Matter of fact, we really want to make the wonton wrappers, I can get it down to almost 1 millimeter thick. I can roll this down to 1 millimeter.
So this looks like a carpet almost. It's a thick carpet of dough. It's amazing.
Nancy's petting the dough.
I'm fondling the dough because it's so soft. It's the difference between eating a wonderful fresh cookie when it comes out of the oven versus the next day. When you can get fresh noodle dough, that's so exciting to me.
Today on our show, we have a whole bunch of food stories on the menu. The theme is Let's Eat. And if, like me, you like a good fortune cookie, be sure to stick around for dessert. One of the first TV celebrity chefs was Graham Kerr. His show was called The Galloping Gourmet. At the start of the episode, he would leap over a chair.
Made it. Thank you so much.
Now, I confess that I missed him at the height of his stardom. His show ran from 1969 to 1971. But when I started watching him on YouTube, I found myself weirdly captivated.
Now you just take this steak.
His persona is just so charming and easygoing and joyful.
Oh, boy. Honestly, apart from my wife, nothing appeals to me as much as that.
His producer on the show was actually his wife, Trina. That chair thing, it was her idea.
Let's have you jumping over a chair, and let's have you carrying a glass of wine. And he said, it's got to go everywhere. We'll fix it. So we put saran wrap over the top of it.
Trina was always there behind the scenes, through ups and through downs. We sent Sound Effects' Posey Gruner to learn more.
Graham Kerr lives in Mount Vernon, Washington, in the home he once shared with his wife, Trina.
This is the two of us when we were 70, with our fingers all interlaced, which we like to do. This was on our boat.
They met when they were kids, in 1945, and he fell for her at a strawberries and cream badminton party.
I took a wild swipe at a shuttlecock, and it went into a huge rhododendron bush, and it got lost. And so Trina and I went diving into this tree. We did eventually find it, but our hands touched in that cool English afternoon, all dressed in white, you know, with strawberries and cream. It doesn't get more British than that, does it? But when our hands touched, I really knew then that this pretty little girl was a girl.
He fell hard. But then Trina moved away. A decade passed.
And then, I was in the army and I was in bed with rubella. I was reading a tabloid. And there, opened the page and there was Trina.
Pretty young Trina Van Dorn won the proud title Miss Jersey Battle of Flowers this year.
Trina had won a beauty pageant in the Channel Islands, and she was having great success in the local theater. Graham very much wanted to be in touch.
I wrote to the Daily Mirror and said, this is my first girlfriend, can you put me in? And they did.
They corresponded, and Trina agreed to meet. The moment he saw her, he fell for her all over again. But he didn't know how she felt.
I took Trina for a walk the next morning, and we came to a cattle crossing, and it was very muddy and wet. And I said very graciously, can I carry you across this? It looks a bit muddy and stuff. And she said, well, okay. So I swept her up in my arms. That was the first time I got a hold of her. And strode out across this cattle crossing and went up to my knee in a mixture of mud and manure, just unable to take another step. And so I'm holding on tight and her face is very close to mine. And she said, so what do we do now? And I said, well, would you marry me? And she said, of course, you know, and we kissed for the first time right there.
Even though she'd agreed to marry him, he had one more request.
And I said, well, you know, if you go on with the theater like you're capable of doing and become a movie star, I don't think I've got what it takes.
Graham admits that this sounds very out of date, but this was the 1950s, and he felt he couldn't handle being married to a woman who lived for her audience.
So I'm going to have to ask you, if we're going to marry, could you give it up? And she looked at me and she said, of course. It's the same word that she said when I asked her to marry her. So, that brings tears to my eyes.
They married soon after. Within a year, they had their first child. A few years later, Kerr was recruited into the New Zealand Air Force, where he became the chief catering advisor. And that's how, by chance, he ended up on one of the country's very first TV programs.
The Air Force were asked whether they would provide an officer to do something on television when it started. So I went under orders, and I cooked an omelette, and it was written up as the best live show to date, which was not hard, because it was so new. There was only 50 television sets in the whole country at that stage. Anyway, that morphed into having my own show. And I was placed between Peyton Place and the Avengers. And Trina's watching me do a program, and she screams. She said, you are the most unutterably boring man in the entire world, and you need to do something about it. I said, okay, so you're so clever. Why don't you produce the show? All right, I will.
She took charge of production right away. Everything she knew intuitively, Graham says, she poured into him, and it worked. The New Zealand show was successful. Then, Kerr made a second show in Australia, and that was a hit. Graham was a star. Meanwhile, back in New Zealand, Trina's star was also rising.
She now had been given the lead role in Oh, What a Lovely War, and I was really nervous about that because it seemed like here was the grease paint again and here was the roar of the cloud, and she was delighted and delightful in the part. And for me, it was,
He couldn't handle it.
So I let her down and was unfaithful, stupid. When you love somebody as much as I love Trina, to fail them so absolutely, just because you think that they may be getting back into something that you can't handle, is so damn self-serving. And anyway, so long and short of it is, she finds out about this, and I'm asking forgiveness, and she can't do that.
Still, they had children, a marriage, and a career to manage.
So we then enter into 9 incredible years in which she is doing everything she can to help me to be successful, except being able to love me and forgive me.
These were the years at the height of Kerr's fame. After his success in Australia, they leapt into Canada. And there, Trina produced his most famous show, The Galloping Gourmet. On TV, they looked like a wonderful couple who were living out the best years of their lives. Graham Kerr was famous. Trina Kerr was nominated for 2 Emmys for her work on the show. But their relationship was broken. Graham had once feared being cast in the shadow of Trina's fame. But in the end, it was Trina who got lost. Trina wrote a poem about it. Later in life, she recorded it and set it to music.
Shadows are different. They seldom are warm. Some are quite chilly, unpleasant, forlorn. Especially when shadows come from the fame of one who is known to the public by name.
The years passed. The show ended. Trina had a cancer scare. She had surgery and she was in pain.
So she was given opioids. Hello? More opioids from the local doctors, more Mogadon to help her go to sleep, Benzedrine to get her up in the morning. And then, because there was an underlying issue of unforgiveness, that was hurting perhaps more than anything. And for that, it was antidepressants.
By the mid-70s, Trina was having serious mood swings.
And she would scream and her eyes would fill with blood and her pretty little mouth would get foamy. It was really scary and awful. And I said, you know, I do think that your inability to forgive me and for what I did now 9 years ago is really the source of the major difficulty you're having in your life. And therefore, I think I need to get out of your life. I love you, but I don't think you need me. She went upstairs and said she'd think about it, came down and gave me a poem.
One is half if left or leaves the arms of one whose life is stressed.
The poem ends, I prefer to be
complete and walk with you along the street toward the other half of itself, to learn with you, to help, to understand the way we lost ourselves. We have the right to right the wrongs to each we've made.
No one alone is wrong.
No one alone is right.
And no one alone is right.
In marriage, we are one.
But love is ours. Not flight.
Not flight.
Still touches me the way that it did at the time. I realized that this was not over. I didn't know how we would get to unforgiveness, but I knew that it was possible.
A month later, their life took a sharp turn. A maid they employed had been praying for Trina. In fact, her whole church had been praying for Trina for 3 whole months.
And in the last month, they'd been fasting and praying 24 hours a day.
One day, that maid came to Trina with a suggestion.
Mrs. Kerr, why don't you give your problems to God? And Trina said, all right, God, if you're so bloody clever, you deal with me because I can't.
So Trina went to get baptized, just to see if it would do some good. And then something unexpected happened.
She catches a vision of a man standing gloriously, radiantly in front of her, who smiles at her in a really, really accepting way, reaches out and touches her heart. And she went back that night and she took every pill she had and she put them right down the drain. And every physician I've spoken to said, you just can't do that. She would have gone into a coma. And she didn't. She had a great night's sleep, got out of bed the next day, and she just shouted out, I've got it. Whatever you get when I did what I did yesterday, I've got it.
Graham had no idea. He had been away on a trip, and he came home 5 days later.
Dropped my bag at the door, which I normally did, and she walked towards me peacefully. And she put her arms around my neck. And she put her cheek against mine. Just held me. She didn't say, I forgive you. She just did. I am a grateful man.
That was the beginning of more than 30 wonderful years together. Trina brought Graham to Christianity, too. Over time, Graham appeared in public less and less, and his star began to dim. But, Graham says, Trina's never did. Even on a private stage, she was as luminous as ever.
Everybody who met us seemed to gravitate to her. I know it sounds odd, but I became the sort of the background for her.
Trina died in 2015, just 5 days before their 60th wedding anniversary. Sometimes he imagines how she must look in heaven. He thinks it might be something like the way she looks in a favorite photo. In this picture, Trina is swimming.
And as you can see, she's got a big smile on her face and she's so free. And I feel this is her now, in this kind of freedom.
He keeps the photo just outside his kitchen, where he can see her every day until they meet again.
That story from Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Let's Eat. Jack Gunter is a well-known Northwest artist living on Camino Island, and he uses an ancient painting technique. It's called egg tempera. It's literally dry pigments mixed with egg yolk. He sells these paintings for thousands of dollars, but a few years back, he discovered his art isn't just visually stunning, it's also quite tasty.
6 or 7 different species of animals will eat my paintings. One time, rats got into my gallery, and they had climbed up to the top of the easels and were standing on the top of the painting, 6 feet above the ground, leaning down, eating the first 5 inches from the top. And any paintings that were on the ground were destroyed from the first 5 inches from the bottom.
There was the banana slug, who ate a looping path of destruction through one painting. Jack named him Slug Casso. And then there were the ants. The ants who became Jack's unlikely muse.
One day I woke up and there were 3 carpenter ants up on my easel eating my painting. And I called up my partner, Carla. I said, Carla, there's ants eating my painting today. And she said, well, you paint with food, you damn fool. What do you expect? So I did a painting, which is right there, Gabriel, which is a picnic basket painting. And I painted a beautiful picnic basket with all this food on it on a checkered tablecloth in my backyard from a still life. And I made a thicker frame with my woodworker, and I made an ant farm across the bottom 5 inches. And then I painted the eclair and the cake and the top of the wine glasses with honey. So now I went out to find some ants. I called up an entomologist in Olympia and asked him where I could get ants to put in my painting, and he hung up on me twice. So then I finally got creative, and I called up someone at Wazoo, and it's a land-grant kind of college, so they had to answer my questions. And the woman, PhD, said, well, the ants you want are in your yard. They're called moisture ants. I said, well, what do you have to do? Do you have to get the queen or something? She said, no, they're in your yard. You put something out in your yard with honey on it, and they'll volunteer for your project. So now the painting's all done, and it's painted with honey under the glass with dirt at the bottom. And I had little things on the side for water and air so that they could be safe. So I go out in the front yard, and I see the hose going down to the hot tub. I look at it really closely for the first time in my life. That was an ant superhighway. I had no idea. There's ants going up and down that hose, going both ways, probably waving at each other as they walk by. It was like I-5 of my front yard. So I took a big piece of cardboard, and I painted I Love Carla with honey in a brush. And I put it right on top of that hose, and I had my painting ready to receive ants with the top off and a little funnel. And I went out about an hour later, and that cardboard was throbbing with life. And the words, I love Carla, were swarming like wiggling words. And then I reached down and I grabbed the big piece of cardboard, and they're scrambling off and running down my arms. And I shook the cardboard into the painting, and son of a bitch, they made this beautiful ant farm. They weren't very happy in there. They were quite upset. And they really didn't understand the nature of their project they were in either. But they did make the ant farm. And the next day I was invited to a bumper shoot show. I was already invited. But the next day I brought this to a bumper shoot show. And it was food-related art that was curated. It was 5 of us. So I figured this is the perfect food-related art. It's a picture where ants are actually eating the damn painting. And it was a hit of the show. And on the second day, Gene Godden, who was writing an article for the PI then, she wrote an article about the show, and she said the problem was that in the middle of the room there was a full-size table and 4 bistro chairs baked out of French bread. And it was a brilliant, brilliant sculpture. And the chairs were really wonderful, and it was all crispy. You could just break off a leg if you wanted to and eat it. But the ants found it. And by the last day, every single ant had left my painting, and they went to live in the bread. And the table and chairs were going to a park at the end of the Bumbershoot show. And so I feel comfortable that my ants are safe, and now they're in Seattle.
Jack Gunter is an artist on Camino Island. We are going to hear much more from him in a future show, and you can see some of his paintings on our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and our theme today is Let's Eat. There's nothing unusual about a kid being a picky eater. I was a picky eater. My son would subsist on fish sticks and Cheerios if I let him. But Casey Rom took this to the extreme. In fact, for the better part of a year when she was 11 and 12, she hardly ate anything at all. This goes back to a specific incident when, after a school lunch of turkey and mashed potatoes with gravy, she got really, really sick. And a quick warning, while there's nothing too gross in this story, it does get into what happens when you get food poisoning.
I just remember, like, stumbling around the house and barely being able to move and body aches and just throwing up so much that, like, there was nothing left at a certain point. And genuinely feeling, you know, in my small mind, like, I'm going to die. This is how I die. And after I started getting better and I wasn't violently ill anymore, I managed to kind of get away with skipping meals, because it's normal to kind of lose your appetite after an illness like that. And then after a couple weeks, I started to notice that my parents were watching me a lot more closely at the dinner table. If they turned away, I would shove something in my sweatshirt pocket, and then later I'd flush it down the toilet. So I knew that I was being watched, and I knew that what I was doing was, like, not normal, but I didn't really think that it was a problem. Like, in the actual act of throwing up, which can be very mundane for some people, I always felt like I was, like, choking for air and, like, I couldn't breathe. And I think that's really what it came down to. And just, it never occurred to me until then that, like, something I ate could cause this to happen to me. And I think that's, you know, early connection when you're that young. It's easy to just say, I got food poisoning. Food can be poison. Food is poison. And that was basically my thought process from then on. My sister started taking notice, and she started kind of getting almost sassy with me at the dinner table, like frustrated that we all had to just keep sitting there staring at me when we had other things we could be doing. And I couldn't get through to them that the reason I didn't want to eat was because I was afraid of throwing up. It's, for some reason, that didn't connect with me verbally, even though that's what connected with me internally. And that manifested in my mom having to come to school every day at lunch and sit and stare at me while I ate whatever thing that I had deemed safe that week. Having a very high-achieving sister and someone that was that much older than me that I looked up to so much, it always hurt me to think that I was disappointing her, even more so than my parents. And my parents were doing their best, and they loved me and they wanted to fix me so much, but I didn't feel the same just overwhelming sadness at disappointing them as I did for my sister. I do remember around that time becoming more aware of the internet and trying to seek answers for myself, because I wasn't getting them from the doctors. And at one point I Googled, I'm afraid of throwing up. And I'd never really used the word afraid before. I would say, like, I don't like it, I don't want to. And so once I searched, I'm afraid of throwing up, it finally connected it to a phobia, emetophobia, which is a legitimate phobia, pretty common one, in fact, especially among women. And once I saw the word, I could search the word, and then I found support groups online and stats and treatment options and different things. So I knew that this was a real affliction that other people were feeling. If it had a name, that maybe I could find a doctor who knew that name. And I ended up printing a bunch of pages, like pre-Wikipedia, whatever I found with the definition, and just kind of sliding them under my parents' bedroom door before bed one night. And they still didn't quite understand what was going on, but they at least were happy to see what I was happy to see, which was that it was a real affliction. And then they found a nutritionist who had heard the word and knew the word and even knew that it had recently been connected to anorexia. And I started seeing this nutritionist, and she put me on a treatment plan that was kind of like a reverse Weight Watchers. It was like portion based. And so she told me she wanted me to eat something half the size of my fist every hour. And it could be anything that I deemed acceptable to start. So that was pretty low commitment. I could eat 5 slices of banana or 7 almonds or something like that, because my fist was very small at the time. And after a couple of weeks of that, it escalated to something the whole size of my fist every 2 hours. And then, you know, 2 fists every 3 hours. And before I knew it, I was kind of eating meals again. And with my anorexia in recovery, I realized that I still needed to recover from the emetophobia, that a lot of the fears and the symptoms were still there. And if I did get into a situation where I felt like I might be sick, if I had a stomach ache, I would, you know, pace around my house and cry uncontrollably. And I kind of developed this mantra, and I would just repeat it over and over and just like walk around the house going, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm not gonna throw up, I'm not gonna throw up. Nobody really understood what it was, but they were just happy I was eating. And so for a long time, that kind of fell onto the back burner. When I was 16, my sister was in college, and she was studying abroad at the time in Prague. And she really wanted me to come visit her. I think she was feeling a little homesick. I was really, really scared. I was afraid of the airplane. I was afraid of either getting sick or sitting next to someone who was getting sick, or, you know, airplane food or weird food in a foreign country that I've never eaten, or water in a foreign country that I've never drank. And I immediately kind of went to all these scenarios, but ultimately it came back to that same thing that pulled me out of my eating disorder, is this idea of not wanting to let my sister down and wanting to, you know, be there for her the way that she had always been there for me. And I said, yeah, I'm gonna go. And I did go. You know, I made it onto the plane and I didn't get sick, and I made it to Prague and I didn't get sick, and I was there for a little over a week, and I flew back, and everything was fine. And on top of not getting sick and realizing that I could experience something without throwing up, and that those two things weren't intrinsically linked, I also realized that I really enjoyed traveling and seeing a new place, and I didn't want that to be taken off the table forever. And I kind of tested it again after college. I found an opportunity to teach English in the Republic of Georgia, and I ended up in a village with a host family, kind of in the middle of nowhere, with foods I'd never eaten and well water that didn't always agree with me, and power outages rendering refrigeration pretty much useless. And I knew then too that I had the same choice, this, you know, choice that I had when I was a child, where I could risk these things or I could starve. And ultimately I knew that starving hadn't worked for me before and that it wasn't going to work for me now. And I risked it, and I did, you know, I got food poisoning more than once while I was there, and I threw up more than once while I was there, and I still cried, and I still said the mantra, and I still panicked and paced around the house. But once it was over, I realized that it wasn't as bad as I built it up to be. I'm never gonna like it. I'm never gonna enjoy it. I'm always gonna have panic attacks before I throw up. I'm always gonna, you know, cry and say the mantra. But ultimately, I can recognize now that it's just a moment. And it's just something I need to get through. And it's not something that I need to occupy my life with.
Casey Rahm is active in live storytelling in Seattle. She has now traveled in 29 different countries. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Let's Eat.
Introduce yourself, please, with your name and...
Okay. My name is David Mickelson, and I'm the founder of the Snopes.com fact-checking site.
There's a thing we do in radio, and I'm actually not too sure why, but to get our recording level set, we ask our guests to tell us what they had for breakfast that morning.
Actually, this morning, it wasn't quite morning, but I had a Big Mac because my wife ran out to do something while I was busy, but... She always jokes that the website runs off of Coca-Cola and Baskin-Robbins.
Well, I value your honesty because, and everyone always says, I had wheat germ and, you know, gluten-free whatever and, you know, 16 leaves of spinach. And I'm like, come on, man.
Really? I'm the poster child for bad nutrition.
Yeah, like I had Rice Krispies and I don't even feel bad about it.
David lives in Tacoma, and on his website, there's a whole section of food-related hoaxes and urban legends. He joined us in our studio, where I asked him about a few.
The one that caught my eye was the potato diet one.
Oh, seen in the last year or two, yeah, on the internet, kind of the claim that you could live indefinitely on a diet of nothing but potatoes and butter.
I want to believe.
Which... I don't know if we want to call it a myth. I mean, it's one of those ones where it's kind of true to a degree. I mean, you could live in the sense of not starving to death for a significant period of time. It's lacking a lot of things that you really need nutritionally for sustained good health.
Right. So I'm looking at the Snopes site right now, and one of the citations is that in 2010, Chris Voigt, head of the Washington State Potato Commission, promoted the merits of tubers by living off of them for 2 months. he ate about 20 potatoes a day for 60 days. And the guy says he was fine, he even lost weight.
Yeah. And it kind of feeds into there's probably a whole lot of foods that you could live off of exclusively for a fair amount of time. And I said living and doing well are two very different things.
One of my favorites, and I don't know if there's any shades of gray here, is the notion that eating an egg and a banana at the same time will kill you.
Yes. That's one of those ones, and it comes out of left field. There didn't really seem to be any, you know, plausible mechanism or even something that seemingly made sense, even if it was totally wrong behind it.
So when I was growing up, I was told that if you drink a Coke and eat Pop Rocks, you will explode.
Certainly, when I started looking at urban legends, yes, you know, it's still around. And it's common when kind of really unique new products come out that there'll be some kind of, deadly safety rumor associated with them, you know, just because they're so different and new.
Unnatural looking,
you know,
probably.
People microwaving their poodle, you know, to dry it off. That, you know, that was common when microwaves first hit the consumer market. There's always some way some new technology is deadly.
Did you find any instances of people microwaving their poodle?
No.
Okay. So do you see them rolling, you know, having multiple lives quite a bit, things that come back in different forms?
I mean, sort of like the stereotypical food contamination legend back in, say, the first part of the 20th century was always the mouse in the Coke bottle. Somebody was always suing because he found a dead mouse in a bottle of Coke. And it's kind of morphed into the Kentucky fried rat, you know, a box of chicken or a bucket of chicken, and there's a fried rat in it or a fried rat head. And it's all these rumors have in common is that they're really implausible if you know how these products are made and manufactured. There's like really no way that a mouse is going to get into a bottle of Coke.
Yeah. Do you think that explains some of the persistence of these myths that people don't understand how our food production works? People are pretty far removed now from
how food gets made, processed, packaged, and sold. That's a big black box, so people fill it in with these myths.
Yeah, oh, well, definitely. And you can kind of trace sort of the history of food-related urban legends as kind of originating, you know, particularly after World War II, when, say, maybe restaurant dining became more popular, and also with sort of the start in the growth of the packaged food industry with, you know, canned foods and then later TV dinners, where people were no longer preparing their meals for themselves, so they couldn't vouch for exactly what was in those foods. And also people were not producing the foods themselves. People were moving away from farms. All of that kind of feeds into the idea of you don't know what's going on with your food. All sorts of weird things could be happening. One we see still pop up with a lot of regularity is the idea that there's a food additive, a food flavoring, particularly a vanilla flavoring that's made from the, like, anal sacs of beavers. It's called castoreum. And again, it's not completely false. That is, you know, castoreum has been used in flavoring of foods, but not it so much anymore. I mean, it's as you can imagine, trying to extract things from beavers is terribly inefficient and expensive. So it's unlikely the average American is eating anything in their lifetime that was flavored with castoreum.
But the substance is real.
Yes, it is real.
It does come from a beaver's anal glands.
Yes, and it has been used in food throughout, you know, history, but just not anymore.
Do you have a sense of whether we are getting closer or further from the truth, broadly speaking?
Just in general? Or
yeah, not just food, but overall. I mean, are we more or less inclined to believe hoaxes and things like that now that we have instant access to so much information, good and bad?
I always like to say that technology changes, but human nature not so much, or only very slowly over long periods of time. So it's not like a whole lot of what we're seeing is new, and people have always wanted to believe things that aren't true.
Do you feel at some point like you're rolling the boulder up the hill and having it roll right back down again?
Yes, I often equate it to, say, housework, as in it's never done, it's never finished, you just do it and then you start doing the same thing over again the next day or a few days later. And it's like, as you said, a lot of it's repetitive. It's not, you're debunking the same rumor, just like you're washing the same clothes and you're vacuuming the same floors, you know, Yeah, sometimes, like I said, it's a little distressing, discouraging to see something completely ridiculous and frivolous. You know, millions of people are looking for or at that thing, but something that actually has a real impact on people's lives is, you know, barely registers as a blip.
David Mickelson is the founder of Snopes.com. He lives in Tacoma. We're going to close our show out today with dessert. For that, we head back to the Souchong Noodle Factory in Seattle's International District. Besides noodles, their other specialty are those crispy confections that tell your future, fortune cookies. Tim Louie, the fourth generation owner of Souchong, told food writer Nancy Leeson and me that there's nothing especially Asian about fortune cookies. In fact, they got their start here on the U.S. West Coast.
It's not from Hong Kong, China, or any part of Asia. Somehow it got invented in San Francisco, associated with the Chinese culture.
And where do the fortunes come from?
So we had a very good relationship and ties with a printing company in San Francisco because of our long history. Matter of fact, he has a business that he can supply many fortune cookie factories throughout the United States with fortunes.
So they print them. Who writes them?
I think he does. You know, I guess he does.
So when you open a fortune cookie and you read it, do you say in bed afterward?
Nancy, you are way behind the times. It's on the internet now.
So high five.
Sorry. I'm always ready for that one. We have 500 different messages that go through circulation. I'm sure he uses it for other fortune cookie factories as well. If I ever get a bad one, I'll tell them to take it out of circulation and come up with something else. For example, we used to sell to the airlines. We got one that says it is best to travel by sea. And, you know, if you're on an airplane and you open a cookie like that, that's not very positive. That's not very happy.
Do you ever hear from people?
Oh, yeah. And so that's when I have to kind of humor it out of them. But then I'll call my fortune guy and say, hey, don't put that one in anymore. It's not a happy fortune.
I just think it's so cool that it's people. I mean, you know, they have this air of profundity, like they come from the Bible or an ancient text, but they probably come from your San Francisco guy's brain in the morning.
That's about it, I think. Yeah, you know, it's very similar to your horoscope. Yeah.
Are they? Well, I guess you'll show us. Are they baked with the fortune inside?
Yeah, yeah. Let's go have a look. It takes about 4 minutes to bake the batter into little round pancakes.
It's so hard not to just reach in there and grab a handful and shove them in my face. So these cookies have no fortunes in them right now, right?
No, they do. They do. The way we put the fortune in, if you look at the very top, there's this nozzle that goes up and down. The nozzle is hooked up to a vinyl tubing to this vacuum pump. So by suction, it picks one off and stuffs it into the cookie and mechanically fold it. Again, this machine has mimicked what my grandmother did by hand. So the fortune is put in after the pancake is baked, while the pancakes are still hot and soft and palatable, or malatable, that you could fold it. As it's ejected out, we blow air on it just to help it set, and then into the box it goes.
Fortune cookies tumbling into a box of the freshest fortune cookies that I've ever experienced.
Can I eat one?
Oh, please go right ahead. Help yourself.
Me too, huh?
Yeah, it might still be kind of soft, yeah.
Okay, your next business venture will be very profitable.
Congratulations.
On the internet.
Oh. All right, I'm going to try mine.
You got that or you want to hold it?
It's okay, I'm going to. My fortune says, you are sociable and entertaining in bed. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I couldn't
help it. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to take a taste here.
You like them?
Wow. Well, I'm stuffed, so let's call it a day. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Special thanks this week to Nancy Leeson, Monica Spain, Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories, and Aaron Hennessy. We had multimedia help from Parker Miles Blom, and our executive producer is Florangela Davila. You can listen to our show anytime, anywhere, when you subscribe to our podcast. Find it on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get your audio. And that includes your smart speaker. Just tell it to play the podcast Sound Effect. We love to hear from you. Send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org or find us on Facebook. Or best yet, rate and review our podcast. It really makes a big difference. And come on back next week when our theme is It's Only Money. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.